Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Chinese Studies. I'm your host, Julia Kablinska, and I'm joined here today by Professor Juliane Nott of the Free University of Berlin, where she is part of the Art Historical Institute. We will be talking about her book, Transmedial Landscapes in Modern Chinese Paintings, which is coming very soon from the Harvard University Asia Center. And it tracks a relatively short but transformative period in ink painting. In the years roughly the same as the Nanjing decade of 1927 to 1937. In her own words, Professor Nott focuses on 20th century Chinese art, or how it was redefined with regard to historical practices as well as global entanglements and institutional frameworks. And although today we will be talking about this most recent book, Professor Nott has also published extensively on socialist period art practice and is currently developing a project on cultural revolution art, which I had the great pleasure of hearing about earlier this summer. But I will let Professor Nott herself tell you more about her work. Welcome to the program, Juliane, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Julia, for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So, as usual, I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us a bit about your background, how you came to study Chinese art, and how your work led you to this subject and this book.
Yeah, basically, I think I was kind of thrown into the field of Chinese art by my parents when they brought me to China as a child. And that was back in 1979. And also they were friends with lots of artists from those independent art groups like the Wuming Huahui. So, so I think I got in touch with Chinese art and modern Chinese art at a very early stage. And I didn't plan to, but it's kind of turned out that I studied art history and Chinese studies and went to Beijing to study there for a year at the Central Academy of Fine Arts. And initially I wanted to work on contemporary art. And then I came across a painting catalog of Shi Lu, and I saw it and I just thought, okay, this is it. And then I started doing my MA thesis and my PhD thesis on Shi Lu, who was a painter, landscape painter, active during the socialist period. And the question that kind of drove my PhD dissertation back then was, or one of the questions was, what makes modern landscape painting modern? So where actually is the difference to pre-modern practices, conceptually and technically and formally? And so for my second book, it seemed quite natural to me to go back in time to the Republican period that came before the socialist period and look at how everything started. And another thing that I maybe kind of posed myself as a challenge was how to write about a painter like Hua Minhong, who is very interesting and very, of course, very famous too, but also kind of, at the beginning, I found him kind of, forbidding in a way, so not so easy to comprehend. And I wanted to make sense of his work for myself, and this is how. So he was the beginning of what became this book.
I see. And we'll get to the chapter on him where we get into that forbidding nature as the oldest, right, of the painters that you consider. Absolutely. But before we go there, I want to turn to the theoretical underpinnings of your project, the term transmedial. As someone who locates themselves in media studies, that's the first term that caught my attention in your book. And of course, it's the first term in your title. What does that mean? What is transmedial practice? And how does that term, and maybe media studies more broadly, fit with or intervene in the discipline of Chinese art history? How are you positioning yourself with this book?
Some other time maybe you should tell me how you think about this term as a media studies person. So I was basically thinking it from the point of artistic medium. So ink painting, oil painting, photography, woodblock printing. So the title is now Transmedial Landscape, but actually it was Transmedial Practice. So it had this, it was a longer title in the beginning, which was too long eventually. and it included the term Transmedial Practice. And, it comes from Lydia Liu's Translingual Practice, actually. So what really helped me think through these processes of how Chinese landscape painting became modern was her idea of translation, of the focus on the host language and on the creative possibilities that emerge in the processes of translation, and also the conflicts that arise in the process of translation, or how these are negotiated when a new term or a new technique is found for a new problem that came from outside. And by looking at how the Chinese painters, or especially the ink painters or guohua painters who were active in during the Republican period, how they engaged with oil painting, with photography, and also with reproductions of paintings, and also various more ancient and indigenous techniques like woodblock printing, is so these citations of one medium in another medium, and the preservation or the modification of the medium specificity of the guest medium within the host medium, I guess, that's comparable to language translation, and that's also where those changes really become visible and feasible. You can kind of grasp them more easily.
Yeah, absolutely. As a media studies person, I would say that this is absolutely up my alley. And it's a great addition, I guess, to this corpus of work about Republican China that has taken this media turn, right, we can say. But before we turn to painting, perhaps let's talk about the first medium that really came into focus for me, which was the art journal, right? And specifically, you talk most about a journal called National Painting Monthly, Guohua Yuekan, that was established in 1934 by the Chinese Painting Association. And you analyze that both the art that was printed or reprinted here, as well as the theoretical conversation that was had between various members of a social network, right? So this journal was a kind of platform for people like He Tianjian, Yu Jianhua, and Huang Binghong, who are the main actors of your book, to come together and think through painting. So how does this magazine and the discussion that emerge here set the ground for the rest of your project? And indeed, the Guohua project that's undertaken by this group of artists in the period that they're active.
Yeah, so the Guohua Yuekan, or National Painting Monthly, was the official journal of the Chinese Painting Association. So that was really a group of Guohua painters who were active in Shanghai, and it was it had lots of members, but Huang Binghong, He Tianjian, and Yu Jianhua all were core members, really. And the initial project out of which this book grew had the title Landscape, Canon, and Intermediality in Chinese Painting of the 1930s and 40s. And so this is more the canon part. So how was the history of Chinese painting, of traditional Chinese painting, of pre-modern Chinese painting, reconceived under the impression that it was not the unique elite cultural expression that Chinese people lived in, but it was one of several options that they could choose. And what were the parts that they preserved, or which were the parts that were criticized, and how did they define it with regard to basically European painting practices? And this is something which can be really traced through the articles published in this journal. Especially, they published their fourth and fifth issues as a special issue, which they called Special Issue on the Ideas of Landscape Painting in China and the West. And they really undertook the project to write about this comparison of Chinese and Western landscape painting on Chinese terms. So they didn't say fengjinghua, which would be the landscape painting in oil or in the Western tradition, but they termed the European paintings shanshuihua too. So shanshui was the basis. And it was writing in a way against this what might be called the realist turn, or the criticism of literati painting that was undertaken since the early decades of the 20th century, and the call for going back to the Tang and Song as supposedly realist painting techniques, when Chinese painting was more realist than European painting. So there's this preserved turn around the Yuan Dynasty, or which they kind of identified, which is identified with the Yuan Dynasty painter Nizan. So he's kind of the culmination, a turning point for the decline of Chinese painting after the Yuan Dynasty. And so there was this discourse that, you know, we have to go back to our former grandeur by going back to the Tang and Song origins. And so this was a rhetoric used by people like Kang Youwei or Xu Weihong, who kind of proposed a realist reinvention of Chinese painting. So what He Tianjian and others did was to say, okay, no, but actually European artists left realism behind, and the combination of European art is impressionism. And so it was this counter-realist narrative that kind of re-evaluated literati painting as the counterpoint, or the partner piece of impressionism. So it's kind of a rewriting or a positive reevaluation of literati painting.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that sense, your book is a wonderful companion also in this podcast to Chinese Ways of Seeing, right? Which is likewise tracing through a different type of practice, a similar type of transformation, right? So I hope the listeners are picking up on a pattern here of books that sort of emerge out of exciting new work that's happening in these fields. So the first case study that you go into after you introduce this network is devoted to He Tianjian, right? Who is a very interesting character. And I'm really fascinated by the way in which you describe his relationship to the landscape tradition, right? You had just talked about how they had to reevaluate the canon, kind of figure out what it was about the canon that they wanted to press into the future as they developed Guohua. And he said, you call the canon for him a painting storeroom of memory. So can you tell us about this figure and what this painting storeroom, how it was composed, how he activated it, how he used it, in fact, to look at the world and find that painting in the world itself?
Yeah, well, He Tianjian was a self-trained painter, and a painter who was really working for the market, and who very proudly claimed of himself that he could paint in any style. And he was kind of overlooked in modern Chinese painting history until you just mentioned Guyi's, Yigu's Chinese Ways of Seeing. So she's writing about He Tianjian too, and also does Pedith Chan. So there's this focus in recent years on Republican period know, social practices and the activities of the Chinese Painting Association. So he has come back to the attention of scholars, which I think is very important, because he didn't really fit into the standard narratives of modern Chinese painting history. And he kind of monopolized the editorship of National Painting Monthly in the last issues, and so he was kind of he was also in a way also caught in this very social Darwinian thinking that kind of formed those competitive thinking about Chinese and Western paintings. But he was very much really, you know, living through the painting styles. And so he had this one article where he described the diseases of Chinese painting, modern Chinese painting practice. So all the mistakes that his fellow painters were making, which can be kind of boiled down to either blindly following the old masters and not having any innovation at all, or being overly innovative and having no foundation in the ancient masters. So the solution he proposed was to first learn all the techniques by the ancient masters for several years, then go out in the countryside and paint the famous rivers and famous mountains for several years, and then finally combine both to find an individual practice. And so I think this is, you know, how he saw his own painting practice. And the way this, what you just said with the storage room of memory, and how this kind of shaped his seeing of landscape, or the way he saw the landscape and painted the landscape, can be or kind of surfaces in one article that he wrote for a publication, which is then in the focus of another chapter, In Search of the Southeast, or Dongnan Lansheng in Chinese, and where he kind of describes landscape through painting techniques. So he uses tunfa, or, you know, those texture strokes and other painting methods to describe the landscape. So it's really like, and I think it's a way of it's a notification system, or no, a notation system. So it's just to convey to fellow painters how to visualize a landscape. He describes it through painting modes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that tunfa then becomes a kind of trope throughout the rest of the book as well for your other protagonists. But you just mentioned, and indeed the next chapter turns to this publication, In Search of the Southwest, which you describe as a very elegant album, and of course with a very romantic title. And the production was indeed, and I quote here, more pragmatic and closely tied to the Kuomintang government's modernization and building efforts than this romantic title may suggest, right? So this album is a multimedia collection of paintings, photographs, essays, poems, and even the calligraphy of the great leader, I say ironically, Chiang Kai-shek. And it provides an infrastructural tour of China's southeast, a region that had just been made more accessible and indeed visually consumable by rail and road projects that the government had been undertaking. So how does this infrastructure underline the album, the structure of the, you know, the texts that of the album, visibly and invisibly, indeed, right? Because that's the claim that you're making. What can you tell us about the role of ink painting in negotiating these modernization projects and learning how to travel like modern subjects?
So, In Search of the Southeast, it's actually a huge book. It's really large, and it's really, you know, it was a very expensive production. It was kind of the propaganda output of something that was at that time called the Southeastern Infrastructure Tour. And this term, Southeastern Infrastructure Tour, apparently referred to a road construction campaign in the first half of 1934, where Chiang Kai-shek had the head of the construction office of construction bureau of Zhejiang province had this campaign to build roads connecting Hangzhou to the provincial capitals of the surrounding provinces, and the most prestigious project is the Zhejiang Jiangxi Railway, which was extended gradually. So in the beginning, it was called the Hangzhou Jiangshan Railway, and then it went over the provincial border and eventually to Nanchang. And that came first, and then there was this tour which was proposed. So it was planned actually to tour people, to tour businessmen and diplomats along these new roads to propagate the new travel destinations to have economic modernity, modern travel come to these places in the countryside. But a major incentive for road building was actually also national defense. So in Jiangxi you had the Jiangxi Soviet. In 1933, there was the Fujian Rebellion in Fujian, which was actually quelled because they had the railway to move troops to the Zhejiang-Jiangxi border very swiftly. And also in all the speeches made by the head of the construction bureau in connection with these infrastructure projects was already the threat by Japan. So this was really always in the background. But when you read the book itself, so it's kind of the chapters are structured along those roads. So one chapter is called along the Nanjing-Hangzhou highway and the Taihu, and one chapter is called along the Hangzhou-Huizhou highway, and then there's along the Zhejiang-Jiangxi railway. Hangzhou Yushan section of the Hangzhou Jiangxi Railway, the Hangzhou Guangfeng Highway, and the Fuchunjiang River. So it's a very long title, but you can see it's really those kind of routes extending from Hangzhou to those other places. And there's two things that really struck me. So one is how the government organized writers and artists to really travel along those roads, but not all of the paintings published in the book were created in these group situations or during those travels. But the editors kind of combined texts and images into a collective travel experience that the reader could identify with and imagine him or herself traveling along with those artists and writers and poets. So this is one very subtle structure within the book. And the other thing that really struck me was that although they have this kind of grid of those roads on which they are traveling, within the text and the poems and the paintings, you can't see it. Or it just appears, in the first sentence, we took the bus to there and there, and from there on, it was set in chairs. So they really traveled in very, very pre-modern ways. So it was really more about being carried by locals up the mountain and then viewing the landscape. And so it was more about kind of continuing pre-modern conventions of travel writing, and also, which was maybe more difficult, landscape representation, because of the medium of photography is quite different in the end from ink painting. But especially in the poetry and in the travelogues, there's this very strong continuity to pre-modern practices. So it's very conservative in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe if I can interject a question that we hadn't prepared before here, but I want to ask you to give us an example, because you do really beautiful close readings in the book. And indeed, in your close readings, we see the scope of the archival research that you've done, right? Finding photographs that match with paintings that sort of you're able in the intermedial gap, let's say, right? You're able to find those invisibilities that are pushed out. And you mentioned this Fujian rebellion, right? So there's a very interesting case in this chapter where we're talking about a painting of a building that seems very idyllic in the way that you say, right? This connection to pre-modern traditions of travel, to the literati. But in fact, you have a photo that you put this painting in conversation with. So could you tell us about this case and what it reveals?
Actually, it's the same photograph reproduced two times. So it's actually the same place. It's actually the identical photograph, and with so it appears in Search of the Southeast in 1935, and it also appears in another in a huge photo book published by the Liangyo editors, which a very beautiful photo book that's called China as She Is. That's a pure photo book with very short captions. And in Dongnan Lansheng, it's embedded in a very beautiful travelogue by Yu Dafu, who's very well known as a modernist writer, but actually he wrote many travelogues. So I think this is in Western language scholarship hasn't caught so much attention yet. So and this he writes in Baihua. So many of the travelogues are in Wenyanwen. So, but he's writing in vernacular Chinese, and he's also really describing the speed of and the feeling of sitting in a car and driving on those mountain roads, and you know, losing the sense of direction, the sense of time, and then he describes how you come, how they arrive at Tianxialing, which is a mountain range at the border between Zhejiang and Fujian and Jiangxi. Actually, it's this kind of three provinces, a kind of border. So you have this. So there's also a mountain pass. So it's the Xianxia Pass, and so he describes getting off the car and then walking back up to this pass and to the old fort of the pass, and describes this as an ancient building, which may in the future be kind of left behind or destroyed by modernization of infrastructure. So there's the sense of looking at something which will pass soon. And actually, I'm not sure if the structure on this photograph that accompanies his text, which is also reproduced in the China as She Is, it's a bridge. I don't think it's the pass, but you kind of, you know, in your mind you connect it. So it's an ancient building, and which is apparently at Xianxialing. So it's kind of there's this connection between this. Viewing this bridge as a relic of ancient China, so a monument in a way. But then I realized, and I realized it actually through by reading the same story or the same travelogue in the published in Yu Jianhua's contemporary Wenji, so later book from the. I forgot. I think from the 2000s something. So, and they credited the text to Shen Bao, so to the newspaper. And then I checked the newspaper for the story, and I realized that actually the story had an important part that was missing in Search of the Southeast, which is that they actually went to a village. And the village was deserted, and the inhabitants were traumatized, and there were soldiers, and saying there had been rumors about a rebellion. And through yet another publication of the of this travelogue from 1933, or from his which had another part. You could really date it to the beginning of the Fujian Rebellion, his trip. And also the in Tainashi is the rebellion is also mentioned. And then you can see that actually there's soldiers and barbed wire in the photograph. But yeah, at least I didn't see when I first saw it in Search of the Southeast. I just thought, oh, this is a nice old bridge.
No, absolutely. And as you could tell by my own slippage, right, I had referred to it as a painting because I suppose I had remembered it as the more idyllic scene, right? And then the photograph is the medium with which I would associate historicity in the present. But since we're talking now about photography, we can turn to the next chapter, which considers Yu Jianhua, who was one of the three main figures and who was most invested, it seems, of them in this contest between photography and ink painting. And in fact, as you say, his works can be read as a statement about the ability of ink painting to truthfully portray the Chinese landscape and to do so even more truthfully than photography, a medium that is associated with scientific modes of vision and representation. So how does that tension between photography and painting manifest? And to tie into the next chapter also, where you talk about the creation of the Standard Mountain, how are Chinese aesthetics reinterpreted through photography? And, you know, take your time answering this question. You can take it wherever you'd like.
So Yu Jianhua was, so all the three painters that are kind of the main characters in my book, so they were all, you know, active in the Chinese Painting Society. And apparently they were not only colleagues, but friends, because they really, cooperated on many levels. But Yu Jianhua had originally studied watercolor. So he was trained in Western painting. And already in the 1920s, when he was still very fresh out of university, he published lots of records of his sketching trips to. So he was originally from Shandong. So his first publications were about his sketching trips to Shandong, but these don't. Those travelogues didn't include illustrations, and I haven't seen any of his early works. Then he moved to Shanghai in the late 20s and kind of started work. You know, being integrated in the Guohua circles and started painting with ink. And he went to Yandangshan, to Mount Yandang, which was also a major travel destination for artists and photographers looking for the true mountains, true waters that they could paint and that kind of were used to reinterpret the, you know, Chinese painting on the basis of landscape observation. And he published a travelogue about his trip to Yandangshan in the Journal of the Chinese Travel Service, China Travel Service, which has the English name China Traveler, the China Traveler, so Yuxing Zazhi. And there he describes in a very detailed fashion how he kind of grappled with doing those outdoor sketching, how he grappled with the weather conditions, but also with the technical problem, and which was the best way of doing outdoor sketching. And then he kind of ends up saying, okay, pencil sketching does not look like ink, and therefore ink sketching is better than pencil sketching. And the albums that he created there at Yandangshan are now in the collection of the Nanjing University Library, because he became an art history professor actually at the Nanjing Art Institute later. And but they were also reproduced in together with the texts in the China Traveler. And then in 1935 and 1936, he created a series of three, actually string bound books, which he hand wrote and hand illustrated. So they're really unique objects that he kept with himself for the rest of his life. So he never published them. And I'm not, you know, he must have wasted so much time and energy creating those books, but apparently mainly for himself. And especially in the first of these albums, which is called Further Travels in Eastern Zhejiang, and which is actually a route that follows the main stations that were kind of always reiterated in all the publications related to the Zhejiang-Jiangxi Railway. So he basically traveled along the Zhejiang-Jiangxi Railway and visited all those famous sites that were canonized within the short period from between 1933 and 1935. And in the layout, he really kind of cited the layout of his own article in the China Traveler. So it's very with the headings, with the text body, with the how the illustrations are inserted into the text body. That all looks like a modern printed journal. Only that, of course, the paintings are not, of course, but the paintings are in color, and the writing is in calligraphy. And he really also plays out the possibilities that Chinese painting offers with different formats. So he kind of cites the long hanging scroll format. He cites the album format. He cites the hand scroll format. And just on the pages of his album, in the format that he chooses for the illustrations, he kind of cites all these different modes of imaging landscape. And in many of these illustrations, you can really see that he actually uses images from In Search of the Southeast and, you know, kind of cites them but overcomes their shortcomings because he is not tied to the limits of photography. So he doesn't have the technical limitations that you need lighting to make a photo, that you have a thick frame for a photograph, but he could just extend them in the images into a hand scroll format, or he could paint the inside of a cave without taking care of lighting situation and all those things. So you can really see how he revisits all the stations that are visited in Search of the Southeast, but then creates an alternative mode of representation based on the non-realistic possibilities of Chinese painting.
Yeah, really fascinating stuff, a kind of zine, but made just for himself, I suppose, right? So how about the relationship between photography and painting in the production of this Standard Mountain, right? What is a Standard Mountain? Tell our listeners how this comes to be.
So, I think many of our listeners will know what Huangshan or Mount Huang is. So, because it's a mountain that has been very famous for its scenic beauty since at least the Wanli period, so late 16th, early 17th century, and which was really also a travel destination for literati in the 17th and 18th century. And also there's this Xin'an or Anhui school of painting that was formed by painters active in the Huangshan region and who frequently painted Huangshan scenes. So there was already this established tradition of Huangshan travelogues, Huangshan paintings, and this kind of a standardized, also very much conventionalized and standardized image of Huangshan. But then also due to the Taiping Rebellion and the overall situation of China in the early 20th century, it seems that this infrastructure that had supported travel during the 17th and 18th century was largely gone. So it was not very convenient to travel to Huangshan. And there was no infrastructure really to support tourism. And with this southeastern infrastructure tour and the building of the Hangzhou-Huizhou railroad. It really became reachable for a weekend trip from Shanghai. So people took the train from Shanghai to Hangzhou, and then took the bus from Hangzhou to Huizhou and up the mountain. And there was the head of the National Relief Commission was an Anhui native, Xu Shiying. So he grasped the opportunity of this road building campaign to develop Huangshan as a touristic center. And also, so there was kind of the infrastructure and the possibility, also the drive to publicize this newly reestablished touristic infrastructure. And as also with the other destinations on the Southeastern Infrastructure Tour, there was a group of photographers. So basically the chief editors of the major Shanghai pictorials were invited to as a group of photographers to travel to Huangshan and take photographs there. And something again quite strange is that of those photographs which were made for this In Search of the Southeast project, most of them did not appear in Search of the Southeast. So it's this chapter on Huangshan where you have a long text by Huang Binhong on Huangshan, and you have a long text by Wu Zhihui on Huangshan, and where he says that Huangshan is that actually Huashan and Huangshan are the standard mountains of China. But if he had to choose between the two, he would choose Huangshan. So this is where this phrase "a standard mountain" comes from. So it comes from his I kind of stole it from his article, and so yeah, you have two long texts, but very little images for a very photogenic and picturesque mountain, and. There's another publication with a similar title, which is called Huangshan Lansheng-ji. So it's something like collections. So it's sort of Mount Huang, basically. And so it seems that it includes photographs by all the photographers who went there on this Southeastern Infrastructure Tour. So kind of. It was an offshoot, and also then they founded a Huang Society and had an exhibition that was shown in Nanjing, Hangzhou, Shanghai, and in Singapore to raise funds for Huangshan. So it was really something that outgrew the scope of this initial Southeastern Infrastructure Tour. And what in the course of all those photographs that were made and also paintings that were made, you can see that the moment that especially when they're put together on the pages of Liang Yu. So Liang Yu also covered this exhibition and had this double page spread where you have the photographs on one side and you have the paintings on the other side. You can see that in print reproduction. So photographs are much more easily reproduced. And with this photomechanical reproduction, than large hanging scrolls. So they really don't, you can't see as much in the reproductions of the paintings than in the photographs. So, and so they, you can also see this very specific mode of mountain photography that is created. So the photos are all quite similar in that they mostly have a pine tree in the foreground and a mountain in the background, and so it's this kind of, it's either the foreground with the pine tree that is in sharp focus, or it's the background, and in the descriptions of these photographs, especially in so there's one article by Chen Manli also published in Search of the Southeast, where he describes how the group went to Huangshan and how they kind of stood on the mountaintop waiting for the rain to stop, to be finally able to take a photograph. But then he also compares the mountain and photography to Chinese painting, but he doesn't really, well, at one instance he says, okay, so it's no wonder that Hongren, who is the main painter of this Yinan school, so it's no wonder that Hongren is such a good painter, because wherever you look, it's a good painting. So you get a good picture wherever you turn your camera. So he's really writing about the 17th century painter as if he was holding a camera and just, you know, putting the lens on any rock and it turns into a good picture. And he also compares the effect of clouds and, you know, of the mountain peaks rising out of the clouds to splashed ink landscape and to the Ma Xia tradition, or the painting of Ma Yuan. So basically Southern Song painting, and that is a painting mode that is very, very different from Anhui school painting. So the painting of the Anhui school is basically very linear, very little use of ink, and very dry. And what the photographers describe is wet ink, you know, washes of black that is contrasting with white. So they're searching for a model in Chinese painting history that can be translated into what they kind of caught with their cameras. So it's they're reinventing the Chinese landscape, or at least the Huangshan painting tradition, or kind of readjusting it to fit their own medium. And this worked very fine, because so Huangshan is no longer conceived as, you know, a very linear and very square kind of mountain, but as a mountain where black peaks emerge from white clouds.
It's a fascinating story. And also, I believe in this chapter, right, we have some images by the photographer who paints with photography, right? Lang Jingshan. So for listeners who are interested in him, you can also find some sort of deconstructions of how those landscapes come together. But now, turning away from photography, your final chapter is about Huang Binghong, right? Who at first it appears he's the least interested in transmediality or this transmedia landscape practice, certainly not as impacted by the pictorial or photographic turn. But you brilliantly read his work in relation to modern publishing methods, right? Those are also new types of media that allow transmedial practice. So can you tell us more about how he mobilizes old and new media, and especially woodblock, that was very interesting, to produce albums, right? So how does he read landscape transmedially, or produce landscape transmedially?
I mean, Huang Binghong is someone who is who's always regarded as a very, you know, the kind of the icon of literati painting in the 20th century. And he's mostly read in terms of, you know, brush technique and reference to ancient masters, and so his paintings are read with his own theories, and also very much his later paintings are much more kind of, maybe his earlier paintings are much less studied than his later paintings. And so there's also not so many of his paintings from the 1920s and 30s that are preserved. And many of the paintings I'm writing about, I couldn't locate. So I found them in reproductions from the time, but I don't know if they are still extant today. And so maybe one reason also for this kind of bias in scholarship is that before he turned 70, he was maybe even more of a writer and an editor than a painter. So he was active in many, many publications. He was active as an editor of Shenzhou Guoguangji, so this kind of series of reproductions of ancient Chinese painting in colotype. But also, he wrote many art historical texts and political texts and theoretical texts. So he was, his activities were very broad, and certainly brought with them an awareness of the possibilities of photomechanical reproductions and the qualities of different modes of printing. And he was another way around, because I was just kind of, when I started, you know, doing research for the project, I really kind of just looked into the library catalogs, which kind of publications they had related to him from the 1930s. And I came across this double or two volume single sheet album that's is called Travel Paintings by Hua Minhong. And I looked at it first because I was interested in his travel paintings, because I had the idea of working on his place-related paintings. And then I realized that actually this album is the single paintings were painted individually. They were not of, they didn't, so they were of different formats, and they also formally they were quite different. So it doesn't look like he painted them as an album or a series, but it's rather small hanging scroll formats, and some are wider, some are narrower. But within, through the printing on, you know, in the center of a white sheet of paper, in this very subtle and warm colotype. So colotype allows you to have the grid. So in half tone, you have those dots. Do you call it? Yeah, I'm missing the technical term, but you know, so it's very, very smooth and comes very close to ink painting. Especially, you know, when it's monochrome ink, and so it's kind of, these paintings were made into an album through the process of colotype. They were not painted as an album, but made into a coherent set as an album through the process of printing, and also in the. So on the back, so it's those single sheets that are put into a sleeve, and on the sleeve you have the title written in Hua Minhong's calligraphy, and on some of them you also have some seals. So I saw two copies, one in the Zhejiang Library and one in the National Library of China. And I think the one in the Zhejiang Library has the library seal right on the cover too. So you have those kind of collectors' seals are employed with this album. But then you also have this very modern imprint and the titles that are printed on the back of the sleeve, together with the catalog of other publications by the Shenzhou Guowangshe. And in the titles, you have this geographical scope where you kind of zoom in and zoom out, and you have very precise geographical information given for every painting. So it really says Huangshan, Shexian, so She County, Anhui Province, and that's the detailedness of those geographical informations, and where you can kind of really track his travels through China. And this is something, which is quite typical. As then I found in the Shanghai Library, I find another album, which is this woodblock printed album that you just mentioned, and which comes, I think, from an interest that he has in local history, Difangzhi, so this local gazetteers, and many of his inscriptions on place-related paintings are actually citations or quotations from local chronicles or from those local gazetteers. So he's really using the texts from these gazetteers and transfers them onto his own paintings. And these gazetteers, of course, often come with woodblock printed maps or representations of the places, especially the mountain gazetteers. So you can see that he cites this kind of linearity of woodblock in some of his sketches and some of his paintings. But then you have this one album which his students and friends presented to him for his 70th birthday. And so it's also very strange because it is apparently a birthday present by his students to him, but the paintings or the pictures are made by him. So it's again paintings tracing his own travels and also numbered. So it's like Huangshan 1, Huangshan 2, Huangshan 3, and Yandang 1, Yandang 2, Yandang 3. And in these paintings, it's so not paintings, but woodblock prints, but it's woodblock prints that so they have this kind of topographical foundation, but again, and this is very typical of Huang Minhong's practice, this is kind of overlain by his own brushwork. So it's really the reproduction of this painterly mode of engaging with the landscape and the way he puts he presses the brush on the paper that is captured in the medium of woodblock. So it's at least two directional kind of. So he's borrowing the pre-modern woodblock prints tradition of those gazetteers, but he's then transforming it into painting, and the woodcutters then can reproduce this painted and his very personal and very individual brushwork.
Yeah, and again in this chapter we see this masterful deployment of archival sources that you say you found in the Shanghai Library. So future researchers, it's a great place to find fascinating materials, but you have to devote a lot of time. Yeah, but you have to devote a lot of time to get the sort of nuance and complexity that Juliana's book has demonstrated to us today, especially during this conversation. So thank you so much for sharing your book. But before we go, I'd like to learn about your future or perhaps current research. So what's new? What new book can we expect to hear you talk about on this channel in the future?
So one project I'm working on is what you mentioned in the beginning, which is on the Cultural Revolution, and where I'm looking at the Cultural Revolution as a 10-year span that was, of course, a very peculiar time in Chinese history and that influenced all people's lives in a very fundamental way. And I'm trying to give or paint an unideologized, is that a word? So an unideological picture of, because I think it's too much. So the discussion of the Cultural Revolution is still too much ideologically tinted, I guess. And what I want to look at is how did artists or people producing pictures in that time, how did they conceive of their work? How did they regard their own role? So be it Young Red Guards producing propaganda posters, be it people like Shi Lu, who kind of was mentally ill and living at home and threatened to be executed and creating literati landscapes that were incredibly expressionist, or people like the Wu Ming Huahui, the no name group who I met when I was a kid, and later who kind of painted anonymously in the parks of Beijing and formed this kind of utopian collective But also people who kind of had the most successful time of their life painting for the national exhibitions in the 1970s created what we now commonly regard as, you know, those typical cultural revolution, Hong Guang Liang, very red and shiny representations of smiling people. And so to give voices to those different positions and see how all these people lived through the Cultural Revolution, that is one project. Another one is on art academies in China. And for me, I will be looking mainly at the China Academy of Art in its early history during the Republican period, when it was the Hangzhou National Art School, and look at how the institution of the Art Academy arrived in China, and how it kind of arrived there conceptually, practically, and pedagogically, and
Great. So you're staying in the Republican period and pushing forward into the socialist period. Wonderful. I look forward to those books. I heartily recommend your book, which will be available soon. Yes?
Yes, it will be. It is currently being printed and will come out in early November, probably, and then might be available a few weeks later.
Okay. So we eagerly await. It will have beautiful images, right? Very, very thorough collection of the art that you talk about, which of course adds a lot of pleasure to the reading of the book. So thank you so much. And I will see you next time when your next project is published. Okay? Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.